Welcome to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. This is your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and on this winter broadcast of Echolocation, we'll be conjuring up sounds of the long night, as well as listening to work inspired by winter. We'll investigate a surprising echolocator, that inveterate mimic, the human animal, in our echolocator profile. We'll also explore the profound impact that human-caused climate change is having on the planet and our winter weather. We'll listen to works by scientists, sound artists, and musicians who are driven to sound the alarm about climate change. This weekend marks the 6th anniversary of WGXC, so I hope you will honor this accomplishment by donating to keep the station on the air during our Radical Radio Fund Drive. To contribute, you can call 518-697-7400 or click Donate Now at wavefarm.org. We're going to start out this broadcast with some very pleasant sounds of winter, so I hope you enjoy listening. The winter soundscape is pretty silent compared to spring's cacophony, but if you're lucky, you'll hear owls, those denizens of the long night, singing during the winter months. Nocturnal creatures owls see in the dark, catching tiny prey just like echolocators, but they're not echolocators. They are creatures of the night with remarkable adaptations that allow them to navigate in the dark. Owls have very large eyes that are adapted for seeing under low light conditions, but it is their acute hearing that allows them to see prey with their ears. An owl's range of audible sound is not unlike humans, but its hearing is much more acute at certain frequencies, which enables owls to hear even the slightest movement of their prey in leaves or in the undergrowth of the forest. And some owl species have asymmetrically set ear openings. One ear is actually higher than the other. When a noise is heard, the owl is able to tell its direction because of the minute time difference in which the sound is perceived from the left to the right ear. And the owl then turns its head until the sound arrives at both ears simultaneously, and then it knows the prey is right in front of it. Some species have a very pronounced facial disc, which acts like a radar dish, guiding sounds into the ear openings. And the shape of this disc can be altered at will using special facial muscles. So let's identify some of the owls that inhabit our area. The recordings are courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The The great horned owl is a call that we hear in the wintertime because they actually nest in the wintertime. And this call of the great horned owl was recorded by Sean O'Brien. A very common owl that we hear in wooded areas in our region is the barred owl. And we can hear barred owls year-round. We have them here at my place in Hanacroy, and I hear them even in the summertime. And they have a remarkable range of sounds that they make, and this recording was also done by Sean O'Brien. The northern short-eared owl needs very specific grassland habitats, and we actually have that habitat in Coxsackie, and Green Land Trust and New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and others are monitoring the populations of short-eared owls on the Coxsackie grasslands. This particular recording was made by Garrett Vinn. The northern saw-whet owl is a very tiny owl, but it's very common. It's one of the most common owls in the eastern forests. And this recording is by Greg Budby. And finally, we'll listen to the eerie sound of the eastern screech owl, which is a very tiny owl that is also common in our forests, but is considered to be supremely camouflaged. So we may not ever see this small bird that nests in cavities, but we may be haunted by the sounds that you hear right now. And this recording was done by Wilbur Hirschberger. Although the winter soundscape is often quite silent, it doesn't mean it's devoid of inspiration. We're going to listen to a wintry composition by Canadian composer and soundscape ecology pioneer R. Murray Schafer. The composition is entitled Snowforms, and Schafer wrote that the piece was inspired by looking out the window of his farmhouse in Ontario, observing the soft foldings of snow. The work is performed by Electra Women's Choir. Thank you. You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. I'm Elizabeth Lojudis, and we just heard R. Murray Schafer's Snowforms performed by the Electra Woman's Choir. Schafer's work was inspired by the beauty of snow, and nature has long inspired compositions by musicians. But more recently, creative people have felt compelled to compose works that focus on the loss of winter and the weather disruptions caused by carbon pollution and global climate change. During today's show, we're going to be listening to works by sound artists and musicians who are concerned about climate change. But it's also really exciting to encounter scientists who are aiming to interpret data through sound. Today we're going to talk to Dargan Frierson and Judy Tweet from the University of Washington's Atmospheric Sciences Department. And the two are producing audio pieces that they describe as infosonics. They're interpreting climate data through sound rather than with graphics. They've produced two pieces that illustrate the impact that human-caused pollution is having on the atmosphere and the Earth's temperature. The first piece that they produced can be viewed as a video entitled The Deafening Rise of Carbon Pollution. And you can find links to the video on our Echolocation Facebook page. Judy and Dargan were kind enough to sit down with me via Skype to talk about their work.
I'm Dargan Frierson. I'm a professor of atmospheric sciences at University of Washington. I do research on climate models, how the physics of climate works, and then I'm very interested in teaching and outreach about the climate with a group that makes YouTube videos about atmospheric science concepts, a group that makes video games about environmental science called Earth Games, and a lot of music stuff as well.
My name is Judy Tweet, and I am actually a fourth-generation Washingtonian, and I study atmospheric sciences here at the University of Washington. Some of my research has looked at the interactions between tropical ocean variability and high-latitude climate. So there's these large-scale atmospheric waves that connect the tropical Pacific Ocean to Antarctica, and we think they have some influence on sea ice variability there. So I've done research looking using global climate models to investigate that problem. And I also do a lot of work outside of the academic community sharing science. So we do these sonifications, and I work with the labor community as well, talking about climate justice and just transition and what that might look like for ordinary people and for workers in King County. So I also organize a speakers bureau that kind of sparks conversations in different industries about climate change, the impacts, and the transition and what that will look like for them.
Please tell us about the aim of sonification or infosonics.
Sonification is taking, well, in our context, it's taking data and turning it into sound, literally. So you can take any signal or any representation and set it to a pitch, a frequency and a volume, and listen to it. And that's what we've done.
You came up with a new term for what we do, which is infosonics, which you could maybe describe one too.
Yeah, right. I mean, most of the communication in science traditionally is visual, and so we're familiar with the term infographics as a visualization that helps explain a scientific concept. And what we're doing are infosonics, where we are trying to explain scientific concepts or just records in some cases through sound instead of through visuals. Although with the videos, we are adding narration and images as well to help build up the story and to explain what it is that the listeners are hearing. A key difference between hearing a time series, so the data that we're showing, and looking at it is that when you're looking at a visual representation, you sort of see it all at once. You can see the end and you can see the beginning. And when you're listening to it, the time is the medium, so to speak. So you have to wait to hear the next year. And it helps to kind of get that sense of change over time and the durations. And also the kind of the randomness, for example, in the temperature data, where temperature doesn't climb up and up every year, it goes up and down. But over time, you hear it rise. And so I think that's a key benefit to sound when you're talking about temporal changes in the climate system.
What was the inspiration for the deafening rise of carbon pollution?
It really came out of teaching. I was my second year in graduate school. I was an assistant for a global warming course and was leading small. It's a large lecture course, but I was leading small quiz sections and talking with students. And these are again courses for non-majors, so non-scientists, and really thinking about how to improve the way that students are interacting with scientific data and, you know, make it more interesting. It's really easy to see people get just inured to too many visualizations. And so having seen that and thinking about how to make it more resonant, you know, I just thought it would be good to experiment with using sound instead of light to, or in addition to light, you know, through visualizations to convey some of these key climate records like atmospheric carbon dioxide or global mean temperature. So it was, you know, there was no kind of big grand plan. It was just experimenting over a few weekends, looking around at different software, trying to find out just through simple web searches if other scientists were doing this. And then, you know, stumbling upon a nice piece of software in the Python library that allows you to write simple sound files. And so I sonified the Keeling curve, carbon dioxide, and shared it with Dargan. And then he added a lot of his sort of creative inspiration to turn it into the piece that, you know, that you've heard now.
And can you describe the Keeling curve?
The Keeling curve is a measurement of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. So this is a observatory run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it started in 1958. It's important that it's in Hawaii because it's far from large industrial sources, so it's sort of a good representation of kind of the background concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's a continuous record from the late 50s to the present. It's ongoing, and what you can see in it and what you can hear in it is that carbon dioxide goes up and down every year with the seasonal cycle, and that's due to the growth and decay of vegetation. But then in addition to that seasonal cycle, it rises every year. So the summertime CO2 has increased from about 280 parts per million, which we think it was in the pre-industrial area, to over 400 parts per million now. So you hear two signals when you listen to the soundtrack. The yearly oscillation and then the slow, steady rise from, you know, humans burning fossil fuels. Dargan, do you want to add to that? Is there?
Yeah, I mean,
there's so much to say about the Keeling curve.
Absolutely, yeah. I think in a lot of ways, the Keeling curve is one of the clearest ways to show the human influence on the environment. That there's this natural up and down with the seasonal cycle. But even after just a few years, Keeling could tell that humans were changing the amount of this this fundamental gas in the atmosphere. And it's gone up 40%. It's 40% higher than before humans had this influence. And I think in the Keeling curve, you can tell, too, that it is, in fact, people. Every single year sets a new record. If it were volcanoes, for instance, that was causing the rise in CO2, you'd see big peaks every once in a while, right? But it's not. It's every single year is progressively bigger. And you can do the calculations, and it's quite easy to show that the human fossil fuel emissions and deforestation from cutting down rainforests is plenty to explain the rise in the atmosphere, that some of the carbon we emit goes into the ocean, causing ocean acidification as well. But then the science is pretty simple behind all this, that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So we know that since it's risen so much, 40%, due to humans, that a large part of global warming must be due to us, mm-hmm. that the rise of that greenhouse gas. A lot of people say things like, oh, well, climate's always changed. How do we know that it's human-caused? Well, the Keeling curve tells you that at least some of it is human-caused. And then if you do the more detailed calculations with that, you find out that the human cause is somewhere between 80 and 120% of the warming is human caused. There's no reason to believe really that much is natural at all. So I think the story of the Keeling Curve is in a lot of ways the most important story to tell about climate change, about the rise in temperature of the planet.
It can be confusing for people to grasp that carbon dioxide is naturally occurring in the air. We breathe it out. Plants use it in their in photosynthesis. And so, you know, recognizing that it is a pollutant at high levels, but natural at sort of background, you know, the levels that humans have evolved with can be challenging. And so we like to talk about rampant versus regular CO2. And you can hear the regular sort of the regular cycle from vegetation in the Keeling Curve, but then you can also hear the rampant rise year after year.
So let's listen to the oscillations and rampant rise of carbon in the piece, The Deafening Rise of Carbon Pollution, and then we'll hear more from Judy and Dargan about the process of making the soundtrack.
Story behind the music is that I write the soundtracks to our video games. So I had up a sound palette that was the 8-bit Nintendo Entertainment System sound palette. So that's what we used in that. It has a lot of digital effects added to it too, but that bloop bleep sound is the original 8-bit, you know, video game type soundtrack. And that's kind of the aesthetic that I was going for, those arcade games that have that really rumbly bass and the, you know, kind of screeching high notes too. So it was that sound palette, and really it was like the first try pretty much ended up sounding good. You know, messed around with the drums a little bit too in the background, and then we added some digital effects too, like tremolo, which is switching between the left and right speaker, right? If it's in stereo. So that left to right movement adds a little bit of oscillation to kind of along with the seasonal cycle ups and downs, right? You get the left right switching. And I like the effect that has too. A little bit of echo, a little bit of reverb and stuff like that.
What has been the reaction to the piece?
I think there's been a lot of surprise. You know, I mean, people have been very interested, and I think the novelty is part of that. You know, people are interested to hear what global warming sounds like, or what certain data sets sound like. And so students, when we play it in classes, I think there is the surprise of hearing science through a different medium for the first time. That's also very, piques a lot of curiosity. So I have started talking with sound artists, and it's not at all new to sonify data in that community. You know, they've been doing this for decades. It's just not been used in atmospheric sciences or in the sciences that are talked about mostly in the public domain. So it's sort of it's novel within this application, but as a practice, it's not at all new in the electronic music community.
Okay, let's listen to the piece on increases in global temperature.
1977.
Hear the temperature rise into the 21st century.
According to both the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and NASA, 2016 was the hottest year in recorded history, and the warmest 5 years have all occurred since 2010. Can you talk about your motivation to produce a piece that focuses on the increase in global temperature?
It's been really hot lately. Yeah. The global temperature has absolutely soared in the last few years. And it's tremendously frustrating to see, even as this is happening, media reports about global warming has slowed down. This is just absolute nonsense. These records were kind of staggering as a scientist to see. The last few years, you just sort of can't believe that it would happen that fast. And we knew that the new temperature would be released. The new report would be released in January 2017. Mm-hmm. So we were ready for that. And we actually downloaded the data on the morning from NASA as they released it. And then we put out the project later that afternoon. So we had it all kind of ready to go, and just added that last note, which was pretty darn screeching.
Right. Yeah. So we actually started it in November, and then on NASA's webpage, anybody with web access can go and download the data, and they have a file that includes the monthly mean temperature and then the annual mean temperature. And so, so we had sonified up through 2015. And then in January, they showed the monthly temperatures, but December was missing because they hadn't processed December yet. It takes, about a month for them to do the processing and the adjustments necessary before they calculate the annual mean. So when 2016 was announced, we immediately added it as the last note to the data set and published that video.
Yeah. And with that one, there are a few different aesthetic choices that we made with the music. The carbon dioxide data has that natural ups and downs, right? That gives you a rhythm right away. But the temperature doesn't, right? It jumps around from year to year more randomly. So that's why we started with the drums right from the get-go to kind of set the pace of the each year appearing, right? Each year of data to kind of sync you with the timing a little bit better. And then we also used scale for that too. Instead of a chromatic scale, we used a different like hexatonic, certain type of hexatonic scale that also I think just sounds cool. We wanted it to be something that we would want to listen to again later. It wouldn't just sound like noise, and using scales facilitates that to some extent. And then I guess the other big part with that is we stopped it in the middle, right? And at the year 1977, which I think this is another part of the story that people don't really get, that 40 years ago, we did indeed know that carbon dioxide was the main way that humans influence the climate, even so much so that Exxon, their scientists reported to the top management that carbon dioxide is the main way that humans influence climate, carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning. And since that time, the temperatures have absolutely shot up, right? Most of the global warming has happened since we knew about it. So that's what we tried to get away from with the story. And, it also sort of facilitated the electronic dance music, right? They like to have drops and stuff like that, right? Where it gets quiet and then, you know, yeah. And this is not like a real dubstep quality drop or anything, but I think it's nice to have a pause where you have a little bit of time to reflect, even in a music piece, even in a very, very short musical piece.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. People can find out more about your work by visiting the University of Washington's Atmospheric Sciences YouTube channel, which is UW Atmos Outreach, or by visiting Dargan's faculty page at UW at www.atmos.washington.edu/Dargan, or by following the links on the Echolocation Facebook page at Echolocation WGXC. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
It is really important for scientists, I think, to work with artists and for artists to work with scientists, that just the data on its own is really difficult to digest. Mm-hmm. You know, even when you look at it over and over and over again, to yeah. really think about what it means is something I think scientists struggle with a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. Really. It's yeah. very easy just to look at numbers, you know,
yeah.
but to really understand what it means, it requires a different kind of thinker.
Yeah.
And it's artists who are equipped to do such things. So I think
yeah.
there's just a tremendous amount of collaboration that needs to be done in that space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, science presentations can tell you humans are changing the planet forever, but you know, how do you digest that information, and what does that mean as a global citizen to recognize that we're both the agents of climate change, but we also are going to have to adapt and respond to it? And the emotional content of science presentations is something that we have not really explored sort of how to do well. So there is a huge role for synthesis between artists and scientists in doing that.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. We just listened to Fizzy Iceberg Underwater, a piece by composer Cheryl E. Leonard, who often uses natural objects in her work. This particular composition uses hydrophone recordings of an iceberg recorded in the Antarctic in 2008. Leonard's website, alwaysnorth.com, describes her recordings and performances. Each piece has a different theme based on an aspect of the Antarctic Peninsula's changing environments and ecosystems, and connects to scientific research in the region. It's difficult for some people to believe that human activity can actually alter the Earth's climate, but we are a highly innovative species that is capable of great adaptation. While our disruption of the Earth's systems is highly undesirable. Our ability to learn from mimicking our fellow creatures is quite fascinating and can yield wonderful results. Today, we'll learn about that most unlikely of echolocators, the human animal. Well, you guessed it. It's that time again. It's time for the echolocator profile. Echolocation is the practice of emitting sound and listening for its reverberations in order to navigate or to hunt. And species as diverse as dolphins and bats and birds and rodents use echolocation, and humans have learned this skill from them. Today, humans utilize many forms of echolocation for uses ranging from underwater navigation to helping blind people get around in their environments without the use of a guide. And while animal echolocators have evolved for millions of years, the first recorded human discovery of this sixth sense was not until the late 18th century. In the 1790s, an Italian scientist, Lazzaro Spanazzini, put an owl and a bat in a dark room and observed that the bat flew effortlessly, but the owl kept bumping into objects. And when he covered the bat's head, it also exhibited some trouble navigating, but when unobstructed, the bat could navigate where the owl could not. A contemporary of Spallanzini, Swiss zoologist Charles Juin, found that blocking one of the bat's ears ruined its navigating ability, so Spallanzini pursued this line of thought, and he eventually postulated that bats navigate using sound. Brilliant thought, right? Well, the notion was considered absolutely preposterous by his peers, and the thought of bat navigation using sound languished until the 20th century. But in the meantime, 19th century scientists began experimenting with underwater sound. In 1822, Daniel Collodine used an underwater bell to calculate the speed of sound underwater in Lake Geneva, Switzerland. And we also began to understand that animals communicate at different frequencies, some of which humans cannot perceive. In 1893, Francis Galton invented an ultrasonic whistle that he used to investigate the hearing ranges of humans and other animals. And he demonstrated that many animals hear at frequencies that are beyond human range. By the 20th century, we were on our way to developing what would be called sonar, a type of underwater echolocation. Sonar uses transmitted and reflected sound waves to detect and locate submerged objects or to measure distances underwater. In 1906, Lewis Nixon invented sonar listening device to detect icebergs. In 1917, Paul Langevin applied ultrasound to detect submarines. These were passive listening devices. They were just listening. They were not sending out a ping. But by 1918, sonar was emitting and receiving signals. And active sonar creates a pulse of sound, that ping, and then listens for the reflection. So the pulse may be at constant or changing frequency, but that's how active sonar works. The actual term sonar was first coined during World War II, and it's an acronym for sound, navigation, and ranging. The word echolocation was also coined during the World War II era. In the late 1930s and early 40s, Donald R. Griffin and fellow Harvard student Robert Gallambos conducted pioneering research on bat navigation. And Giffen coined the term echolocation and did much to reveal the world of bats. He published the classic book Listening in the Dark in 1958, describing the biological sonar system of bats and how they use it for both high-speed collision avoidance and to locate, track, and capture flying insects. So Griffin's discovery of bats using sound, high-frequency sound, to navigate and to hunt was revolutionary and controversial at the time. Griffin once likened the discovery of echolocation to finding a magic well, and indeed, humans have applied this technology in many fields, from medicine, ultrasounds, to defense. The Navy uses sonar to detect submarines, to fishing to locate schools of fish, in oceanography to map the ocean floor, in oil extraction to search for oil on land. And the coolest application of echolocation to me is when it's used by blind people to navigate. In the 1940s, researchers began to realize that some blind people navigated using what was termed facial vision, or using sound reflecting off target objects to navigate. The echo of footsteps, or even the clicks made with the tongue on the roof of the mouth, allows humans to practice their own form of echolocation. And while a minority of blind people use echolocation, some people are showing extraordinary results from the practice. Human echolocation has important differences from bat echolocation. Dolphins who echolocate use a special structure in their nose that can produce 200 sonic pulses per second. And bats can produce 10 to 15 short, loud clicks each second. But people can only make 3 or 4 clicks per second and produce sound waves that are at the center of our hearing ranges, rather than high frequency, which are not necessarily the best for conveying detailed information about objects and the environment. In contrast, because of the higher pitched hearing range, the bat can perceive tiny insects using their echolocation pulses. But although many humans don't have the skills of bats, echolocation is an effective tool for blind people. Daniel Kish is someone who has been blind since childhood, and he hikes and rides bikes and is extremely active using what he calls flash sonar. He makes a clicking sound with his mouth, and as the sounds bounce back, he creates a mental image of the surrounding space. And he teaches this skill to blind children through an organization that he founded called World Access for the Blind. And the tagline is, "Our vision is sound." And it teaches blind people flash sonar so that they can conduct what he calls perceptual navigation. They use long carbon fiber Kevlar sticks, which are much longer than a traditional cane. And the clicks from the sticks actually light up areas in the visual cortex, and blind people can learn to echolocate. Some folks that have used echolocation have been able to roller skate. Daniel Kish rides a bicycle. So flash sonar gives blind people independence and mobility. Research has proven that both sighted and blind people can learn echolocation in a relatively short period of time, but studies show that when blind people echolocate, the visual cortex area of their brain is activated, and this is not as common with sighted people that echolocate. So this technology can be taken to another level where computer-assisted echolocation can create the clicks. Kish dreams of an implant that will send high-frequency pulses into humans' ears to help them echolocate. And right now, devices are being tested for smartphones to become echolocation, to send echolocation clicks, and other instruments, including the Sonic Eye, which is a helmet with a headphone device and an emitting device that mimics bat echolocation, records the ultrasonic chirp, and then instantly slows them down for human hearing. And also the Smart Cane, which is the combination cane and ultrasound system. So it's pretty cool innovations to allow blind folks to be as adept at echolocation as bats. So that's all on our echolocator profile of the human. That mimicking, innovating, mouth-clicking, engineering, surprising echolocator. In the second hour of the show, we'll listen to a sonic work that was inspired by human echolocation, Vespers by sound artist Alvin Lussier. So stay tuned. I'm Elizabeth Lowe Judas, and you're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wavefarm Radio at wavefarm.org. You can find us on Facebook at Echolocation WGXC. Don't forget to make your contribution to keep WGXC on the air. You can contribute by calling 697-7400 or just go to the wavefarm.org website and contribute online by clicking the Donate Now button. Thanks for listening and for supporting Hands-On Community Radio. We're going to close this first hour listening to a bit of the Dawn Chorus. The days are getting longer and the birds are starting to sing again, so let's take a listen.